Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our most recent episodes. Last week, we talked about the rules of the game. Before that was Fritz Lang's M, Phantom Thread before that, and Little Women and Uncut Gems before that. My book is now on Amazon. You can purchase that if you like. Just search content about content. It's the title. My name is Alex Stevenson with a PH. And yeah, you can buy it for $10. But yeah, let's get to it. All right, James, we are here talking about a movie as we do.
Mm-hmm. And this time we're going to talk about The Long Goodbye.
Yes. Directed by Robert Altman.
Yeah, 1973. Mm-hmm. Another Philip Marlowe, the continuing adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Yes, most famously played by Humphrey Bogart, but has also been played by a variety of people. I think he was played by Robert Mitchum later in the 70s, an actor whose name I'm forgetting between Bogart and Marlowe. But yes, probably the second most famous iteration of Philip Marlowe is this one, the Elliot.
Yeah. Film. Yeah. And so the screenplay was written by Lee Brackett, and she also co-wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a couple decades later, but it's sort of the, you know, we're dealing with the same characters, one of the same co-writers. But there was a very intentional effort to update it between Brackett and Robert Altman, right?
Yes, in that I think, I don't think, judging by everything that Robert Altman has said about making this movie, it's that he didn't want to make a Philip Marlowe movie. So it was like, this is a Philip Marlowe movie directed by somebody who doesn't want to make a traditional noir movie. And I think that that shows pretty much immediately. I think that's the sort of like thread of interest that's really carrying you through this movie. And, I don't know. I've probably voiced this on some of the podcasts we've done before, but like, I like noir. I get it, and it's just not my favorite genre. So, but watching something like this, where you're kind of toying with conventions of noir, but also I think this movie even stands apart from other neo noir movies. Like, it feels pretty unique in general, even still. And I just think it's there's some weird, cool little concoction that that Lee Brackett and Robert Altman were able to come up with that is just I don't know, it's kind of hard to put my finger on at times, but it's just incredibly enjoyable to watch, you know?
Yeah, and it seems like, from my understanding, that Robert Altman saw the script that she had written and liked that it was different and ended up changing some pretty significant things about the plot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the notion of let's do something a lot different. Let's really play with these, with this character. Let's play with the idea of someone with the, you know, the noir sensibilities and attitude from, you know, decades earlier. Mm-hmm. And modernize that. And so it seems like it kind of morphed as they went along with the idea, but the kernel of let's not just redo this. Let's not remake a movie or do something that could have been done back then. Let's have some fun with it. Let's kind of bounce some modern ideas off this pretty old, you know, structure.
Yeah, exactly. And that was pretty a very Altman thing to do at the time. Like, if you look at the first half of the 70s, basically every movie that he makes is very clearly toying with a not necessarily a genre, but a type of film that came before it and sort of injecting a little bit of modernity into it, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller is another famous one from this time. Nashville, I think, is 75. And MASH, of course, one of his most famous movies. But yeah, there was just sort of an early period Altman statement. Staple was to sort of make a movie that was like vaguely familiar to you already, but to just sort of add his little twist to it. You know?
Yeah, and I think vague is a good word for this movie because it feels like everything's at a distance, and I'm sure we'll kind of hit more of these things that come up specifically. But I don't know. It always kind of feels like the story is sort of a step away from the film itself. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so for example, I guess the most famous part of this movie is the intro, and there's a scene that's about 10 or 12 minutes of Marlowe feeding his cat, mm-hmm. or trying to feed his cat. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is how we kind of get to know Marlowe, and we certainly aren't kind of dropped into the action of this case, of this story. And as I said, you kind of feel separate from it, and there's a lot of things that are done with the story and a lot of things that are done with the cinematography and kind of all the filmmaking that kind of makes me feel that way. But I guess we should start with that famous introduction.
Yeah, it's great. Well, it's just sort of the idea of, like, we're introduced to, the shot opens on, as we're hearing Hooray for Hollywood, the song, a piece of artwork that's in Marlowe's apartment that's an image of Hollywood, you know, and we're the camera tracks over and we reveal Marlowe in bed. We find out it's 3 a.m. after his cat wakes him up and he starts talking to himself / the cat. He's still dressed. He's asleep with all the lights on. Like, he just comes off as looking like a loser immediately, you know, like, yeah. My first assumption was, the first time I saw this movie, was that he's like passed out drunk, because that seems like something that, my understanding of a noir character would do. We don't see him drink that much in this movie. We see him drink casually pretty frequently, but not like, let's party.
Well, and relative to the person he's drinking with, he's not really drinking much at all when
yes,
he does drink.
That's true. That is true. But yeah, it sort of just gives this impression of like, if you fall asleep in a suit, you know, like, I'm never going to think that you made a decision to go to bed, you know, like, yeah. That sort of came over you, you know, and lights are on as well. And he immediately has to feed the cat. But the thing that I think frames Marlowe from this point going forward is that, like, he's a private eye, but he can't even fool a cat into eating a brand of cat food that isn't like his one preference, apparently, you know, like that concoction with the eggs and ice cream and salt, which is repulsive. And then he just leaves on his floor, and we never get any indication that it's ever cleaned up.
It's not as though it's just like the dish placed on the floor for the cat, like, it's knocked over and obviously spilled.
It's so disgusting. Like, that when Augustine and all those people come into that apartment stinks and nobody mentions it, you know, like, there's so much dairy on the floor of the kitchen that has been left for so long. But I digress. But it sort of it gives us a chance to sort of see how Marlowe operates, right? Like, immediately we see somebody else forcing him into action, even though it's a cat, you know? And that sort of gives us an example of his surroundings, and we see his neighbors at that point. We see him talk to them a little bit, the women who are hippies and just hanging out on their porch at all times. And we see him try and go serve somebody else as opposed to serving himself. I mean, he's serving himself in some capacity because he wants to sleep, but he does have to react to the cat's needs. And I do think it's notable that, again, when he brings back the cat food, which was not the brand that the cat wanted because they were out of that, again, he tries to fool the cat and just cannot. So I think it's kind of notable, like, how this movie sets him up, not necessarily as a loser, but as somebody who has trouble succeeding, I guess, you know. I know that's different versions of saying this, or different ways of saying the same thing, but I think that there is a distinction there.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot sort of going on in there. First, I mean, just the length that he's willing to go to try to fool this cat. Mm-hmm. Like, when he's handling wet cat food with his bare hands, mm-hmm. It's very gross, but yeah. I mean, it shows sort of level of commitment. I mean, he really wants to feed this cat. He is a good owner or a good companion to this cat, and his capacity for friendship sort of works against him as we sort of see this entire film play out. So it's kind of interesting to see that happen so quickly as well, you know. And so some of the things we'll see throughout this movie of you know, him literally willing to get his hands dirty, the deception, the nature of his relationships kind of blinding him. I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And We get, you know, when he's speaking to the grocery store clerk, he says, "Why do I need a cat? I've got a girl." this notion of Marlowe and so many private eyes, you know, this is something that connects him to the rest of the genre, is just being a lonely person, you know, having no kind of singular companion. There's we always see these PIs who have friends and they have contacts, and you know, he has people he knows throughout this. You know, he has Terry Lennox comes and, you know, is seemingly a friend for a while. He has that person who owns the restaurant who he seems to get along with, who takes his messages for him and stuff. You know, we have these people in his life that are he gets along with, but just that notion of having someone very close to you, having a true partner, having a complete companion, whether it be sort of romantic or otherwise, is something that we just don't often get from this genre. And the recurring theme of this, of cats and his loneliness, I think is sort of an updated, interesting way to get a lot of that sort of independent nature about him across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And going, you mentioned Terry Lennox, the end of that intro is Terry Lennox showing up and, at Marlowe's apartment as he's getting back from the grocery store and eventually asking for a drive to Tijuana. But before then, they play their dollar bill game, which is like a betting game to fool somebody about the numbers that you have on your bill, right? And Terry Lennox is able to fool Marlowe, which again sets the table for what's about to happen, you know?
Sort of just between the cat and Terry in that first, 10-minute scene, he fails to trick somebody and then successfully gets tricked by somebody else.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly.
We get a lot of what we're going to see Marlowe sort of bump up against for the next, 90 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And then we also get we never see the cat again after that. Like, as soon as Marlowe can't serve the cat's needs, the cat takes off, you know? And I think that's not a lesson that he learns, but something that it seems like he kind of feels anyway. It's that, like, if I stop serving people, then they're going to disappear. And that's exactly what the cat does.
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. We as I said, we kind of hear about cats and the cats get mentioned throughout. There is sort of always this underlying theme of that, that loneliness and that disappointment and sort of failure to keep this person around is pervasive. But yeah, we don't see that cat again, even though it gets asked about and kind of shows up in more ethereal ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think we should talk about the long goodbye song, because I think that's kind of a lead into a lot of things in this movie. Like, there's two songs used in this movie, I think. One is the Hooray for Hollywood song that opens and closes the film, and the other is the long goodbye song. But
I didn't realize John Williams did the music until I saw his name, and I'm ready for the most, you know, orchestral, wide-ranging thing with everyone having their own theme and intro and stuff like that. And absolutely not what you get here, but it is a very interesting use of music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hear the same. I think there are six different credited artists in the end credits for playing different versions of this song, and you hear it in all sorts of different scenarios. And the most notable one, I think, is in the opening credits, when we have both Terry, who we haven't really been introduced to yet because we haven't seen him speak to Marlowe, and we also have Marlowe, and they're both listening to the radio, and we're intercutting between their drives. And they're listening to the same song, but they're different versions of the same song. And I think that is indicative of their relationship. Like, they get along, but they don't translate this music in the same way. Like, they don't hear it the same way, because they're fundamentally listening to different tracks. And that sort of, like, plays out throughout the movie. We get sort of different translations of this song. I think it's worth noting that that's sort of also indicative of the way this movie treats Marlowe. You know, you get sort of this character from a Raymond Chandler novel. He's a famous character. He's been played before by Humphrey Bogart, who at this point is probably still, like, one of the most well-known actors in Hollywood, you know, regardless. I honestly don't know if he's still alive at this point, but he's certainly still well-known, you know?
Yeah.
And you just it's a totally different take on Marlowe. So it's like a different version of the Long Goodbye song is underscoring the Altman treatment of Marlowe. And I think, you know, it's so prevalent. The song's so prevalent in the movie that even the Wade's doorbell is a couple notes from the song, you know? And I think it's just,
I
it's,
love that.
Oh, it's so great. It's such a nice touch. And it's just, it's everywhere, you know? And, but it never sounds the same to any two people by what I could put together. Every new place translates this song in a different way, and nobody's really speaking the same wavelength. And I thought that was a cool approach to something that, again, going to the 1970s, like having your movie have a theme song is not uncommon, you know? But this is an uncommon way to treat that common idea, you know? And I thought it was very cool.
Yeah, no, it is cool, and sort of rounds out this whole vision. Like, as I said, there's, they use sort of filmmaking language in different forms of it to tell, sort of to communicate a lot of the same points, like the way that that song is different for different people, you know, different houses maybe, or different that scene you brought up is a really good one of two people driving at the same time listening to kind of the same song but extremely mm-hmm. different versions. Just watching Marlowe throughout this movie interact with people, it just never feels like he's fully engaged, even when they're having conversations, whether he's getting along with the you know, the yoga girls, as I think they get called, who live close to him. They seem to get along, you know, there seems to be no animosity. She even kind of compliments him very directly and says he's what, like the best neighbor ever or something. But it does always feel like there's a distance. Like, they don't feel like good friends. They feel like neighbors who get along well and probably do favors for each other somewhat regularly. But you just don't get this sense of closeness. And even when he's speaking to the police officers, Marlowe is, you know, it's obviously contentious, but it feels like they're having different conversations. It never really feels like they're engaged in the same, really engaged in the same dialogue. And it's the same with all his conversations with Marty. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that kind of Marty Augustine, like the way he talks, I think is sort of meant to be, sorry to cut you off, but it's more indicative of just a rich person, you know, like when you're around somebody who's like really rich and they just have the conversation they want, you know, and yeah. They don't even listen to what you're saying, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's true too. He's just kind of a sometimes fun character. But yeah, even the interrogations at the police station or at his house, when he's speaking with Roger Wade, it always feels like everyone's, they're speaking the same language, but there is this very stark lack of communication. There's just really not a, like, you can't diagram the information that's being passed back and forth as it reaches a logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. There always just seems to be this entropy where they can't, intentionally or not, just aren't really speaking to each other. They're often talking past each other, and I think that's part of getting across this idea that Marlowe's a bit out of place, out of time, is that the communication is just never super effective.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that goes on Marlowe as well. Like, he talks kind of to himself in the middle of conversations with other people at times, yeah. You know, like it's just, he's cracking wise for his own enjoyment and, and not really, even trying to figure out what other people mean until like certain moments in this movie, like when he's trying to figure out why did I get released from prison? Or later on, when he's, talking to Eileen after Roger, her husband, has killed himself. Those are pretty like, there aren't a ton of moments where he's like actively really pursuing something. Most of the time he's content to just sort of like sit in the scene. And as long as he's continuing to entertain himself, then he's fine with it, you know? And yeah, you're right. It is a lot of people, talking past each other or talking for their own benefit and, not really trying to communicate. It's just sort of, it's noise, not communication.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting way to do things in any kind of film, but if it's a detective film, you know, this is, I can't think of a genre that is more about trying to ascertain information, right? This mm-hmm. It's so inherent to that genre, is there's a mystery and we need this piece of information to lead to us to here, to lead us to this person. You know, it really is supposed to be all these dominoes, which is what makes it so interesting that there is this meandering, or Marlowe talking to himself, as you said. You're not able to find more information there. You're supposed to be getting it from your surroundings, from people around you, and it's just that's so much on the back burner in this film.
Yeah, for sure. And what you're saying about detective films, I mean, specifically noir films are so information based, you know. And I know noir movies are about detectives, you know, but like, yeah. I think the way that the detective story has sort of evolved over time is that, like, I think you can get more towards something that's about the detective as a character, whereas noir has sort of maintained this perception of about being fact driven, you know, as opposed to character driven, and fact and plot driven, you know. And I think that's a really crucial distinction to point out, how this movie treats a noir character and noir as a concept, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's a good time to talk about a bit about Marlowe sort of being out of place. You know, mm-hmm. we've talked about him in conversations, but I mean, they'll talk about his suit and tie that he wears. He is smoking for 100% of the scenes in this movie.
And I don't think anybody else ever smokes in this movie, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think he's the only one. Yeah. And there might be some of those group scenes and party scenes where somebody else is smoking. I wouldn't be shocked, but...
I bet there's not. Just sort of the way the movie feels, it really feels like that was the decision. Marlowe smokes and nobody else does.
Yeah, and, you know, this is very... These are things that we very much like. That's a top three things you would say about noir movies is people smoking. You know, that it's such a staple of the genre. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know if you kind of had anything to say about the way that he's still sort of stuck in this time period, but very much, you know, surrounded by the 70s. Even one thing we didn't talk about in the beginning about him waking up, you know, it's as though he's just been on pause since we kind of left this genre off, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you've read two things about this movie, one of them is probably Robert Altman talking about how he would refer to Marlowe as Rip Van Marlowe when they were filming the movie. Just the idea that, him waking up at the beginning of the movie while dressed in a suit is very, very much a choice to sort of show him as this character who just sort of like slept for 20 to 25 years, you know, and he's a man from a different time. It's just sort of been transplanted into 1970s. And I think it is worth noting that the intro to this movie is something that was an Altman idea that he added to the movie after he came along. And that's sort of the thing that kept his interest with this movie is the idea of being able to toy with eras and noir as a concept and the depiction of Marlowe himself, you know. And I think you see that a lot, as you said, in the fact that he's smoking constantly. I assume lighters exist in the 1970s and are easy to carry around, but Marlowe always uses a match, you know. Nobody else smokes in the movie. He puts on a tie to go to the grocery store at 3 a.m. like, and he's always wearing his suit. His car, of course. And I mean, even like his suit just looks dusty, you know, like it looks he never looks clean in this movie, Marlowe, you know. And it just always looks like, I don't know, it's just sort of this almost like he's putting on a show without realizing that he looks like an idiot, you know, and or he looks out of place, I guess. And I think that it hits pretty hard visually. Like, you get all of these indicators that I just listed, but also like I think the thing that's the most interesting is that I don't find Elliot Gould's performance to be particularly 1940s, you know, 1940s, 1950s. I think it's really interesting to see somebody who reminds me so much of the 1970s in Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
But he's like wearing this Marlowe suit, you know, like that's the most interesting dichotomy, I think, is that just that casting of somebody who in no way fits in with noir to me, both at the time and certainly not now. You know, like if you're picturing Elliot Gould these days, you're probably picturing him from Ocean's 11, you know, which is just very much not a noir type of character, you know. And I think that's the really interesting thing about this movie, and something that again makes it helps make it harder to grasp, just because I think if you put somebody who's more straight ahead and sort of like, you know, like a, I'm trying to think of a 1970s example, but whoever the, I guess Robert Mitchum, the guy who played Marlowe later, if you put somebody like that in this movie, I think the Rip Van Marlowe thing kind of looks corny and becomes a gimmick, you know, and it's like too much. But having Elliot Gould, who is sort of this, who feels very 70s. I mean, I think he's the first person who hosted SNL 5 times, you know, he's very like tied in with the early days of SNL, which is also a very 1970s thing, and all these things coming together, and you put him in this character who's actively toying with the idea of how people used to be in the 1940s and 50s, I think is adds an extra layer that is really, really, I think, takes this movie up an extra notch. You know, I think it's such a key decision.
Yeah, and I think that even you could have him, but you could have him do, I mean, you could have Gould, but you could have him play it a lot more 40s, mm-hmm. 50s.
Yeah.
You know, take somebody who we still align with a lot of these kind of 70s ideas and products, but have him play it the other way. But he doesn't, you know, it's not stilted. It's not, he has a couple kind of cool lines, like a couple things that you would want from a more of a classic noir like that. But between the way that the characters just mumble or misunderstand what's being said, you kind of get lost in pretty conversational dialogue, and the fact that some of it's clearly improvised, that that's so not that time period of filmmaking to me. And so I think it's important that the casting is who it is, but the way that it's played as well, it's a sort of deliberate step. And I think that even, you know, we talked about him smoking, and gotta love lighting up a cigarette the second you get inside.
You know what I mean? Like the second you wake up, to the point where like his wall is just covered in these marks from the matches that he's got.
So quick aside, one thing I want to say on him waking up is, in screenwriting, my understanding is that it's sort of a big no-no to have your character start with your character waking up. Mm-hmm. You know, you're supposed to catch them sort of in the middle of something, because it's so obviously, you know, clunky beginning to have them like, okay, they'll wake up and they're brushing their teeth, and then you'll see what a day in the life is like. You know, it's so sort of cliched, but this is just, I bring this up because I think there's a lot of examples of just them not doing the straightforward thing, not doing what, a screenwriting textbook would tell you to do, including him waking up, sort of having this meandering beginning of 10 minutes where the plot really isn't moved on at all. Mm-hmm. You know, this movie very deliberately kind of breaks some of the rules. And I think that it's super telling. And I think when you're trying to make a noir movie that is different than a noir movie, you know, a classic noir movie, that breaking a lot of these rules, but doing it in an engaging way where we're still learning about character and atmosphere is very interesting. But the idea of him smoking, I think, is, you know, obviously, as we said, a big part of the genre, but I think it's also meant to just show him so out of place. You know, we mentioned that other people don't smoke, and I think it's, 70s Hollywood, and I think people are supposed to be a bit more health conscious, and the fact that that's what he is just doing constantly, mm-hmm. nobody else is doing, I think does a lot of the legwork of making him seem so different.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
So I guess plot wise, we're probably at when he gets interrogated, you know, first in his home and then at the police station.
Yeah. Yes. You know, but I don't know. We kind of just need to, I think, jump from the, I think this is just sort of, it's engaging to watch and all these things, but it's not, it doesn't feel like something where we need to hit all the plot points, right? Because we're kind of getting to a point where he needs to, we just have to get him to the Wades, right? Like that's the next real step, because he hasn't met Eileen and Roger, and I think that's what really kicks things off. Like he learns that Terry is dead. It seems like he's not 100% convinced that Terry is actually dead, or maybe that's just the Marlowe charm, I guess.
I think that's right.
Sorry?
I think that's right, that he doesn't really believe it.
Yeah, and well, he definitely doesn't eventually, but it's just whether or not he doesn't immediately, you know? And I think, you know, he's sort of investigating the Roger's disappearance because Eileen has called him, and I think that leads us to what you were talking about with the sort of Marlowe's not really health conscious. We get the Dr. Verringer and that sort of like that clinic, whatever that clinic is. We don't get a lot of time there, but I think talking about the 1970s, if you know, we know Roger has gone there to sort of dry out to because he's an alcoholic. We also know that clinic doesn't work for Roger, and we also get Marlowe actively referring to Dr. Verringer, who runs the show, as a quack later in the film. Like, we don't think you're a real doctor, you're a quack. And I think that's something that plays into that sort of 1970s almost like the old establishment versus modernity thing that I think is running throughout this movie, you know, just that you get Marlowe like talking, Dr. Verringer feels like a 1970s sort of a guy capitalizing on the sort of hippie movement of people going to these clinics or all these things. And I'm not talking about these things in real life. I'm talking about the way this movie treats these things. Yeah. And certainly in the 1970s, that to somebody who's old fashioned, like Marlowe and like Robert Altman is, it seems like the perception of this movie is that, one, these things don't work, and two, that they're run by fools who are just trying to take your money, which is exactly what Dr. Verringer is doing. He's, the two other times we see him show up in this movie is to get his money, right?
It's just tough to know where they really land with that, because he is showing up to get his money. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of told that we shouldn't trust him and that he's a quack. It just, we don't see what the dark side of it is. We don't know that he's truly fleecing these people. You know, if he's showing up because someone didn't pay their bill for services rendered.
Yeah.
You know.
Why is the doctor doing that? You know, like it's a big clinic. He's got to have somebody who can do collections for him. You know?
Yeah, no, I know. It's something that, as I said, you just feel like you're never getting the whole story on what that is. Mm-hmm. It's just one way that this, another way that this movie kind of has these questions and just kind of floats through the story without hitting what you would imagine would be a lot of important points in a more classic detective film.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what we're getting at is the idea of the quote unquote, the establishment, you know, versus modernity, that I think is in constant conflict in this movie. You know, we see Marlowe living across from those women who are, again, they have basically the same apartment that's flipped, and but they're just approaching life in two totally different ways, right? And we also see that this movie doesn't, I don't think, really paints police in a very, very good light, you know? Like, I think it not only does it show them as being abusive both verbally, and I think from what we get with the grocery store clerk who is arrested, sounds like the cops punched his girlfriend and he had to punch a cop and that's why he's in jail, you know? And so we see them being verbally abusive. We hear about them being physically abusive, and we also don't really see them solve any problems, you know? And I think that the idea is that they're there, but they're not really doing anything, you know? And I think we're meant to see Verringer kind of like that, you know, and he's there, he's performing actions, but they're not actually doing what they're supposed to do. And and I think that's kind of the, I don't know, the idea of the, there's all these things happening, but they're not really doing anything. Whereas somebody like Marty Augustine is actually sort of like enacting change in some capacity, you know, not positive change for the world, not positive change for various people that he comes in into contact with, but at least he's doing something, you know, and something that leads to something. Whereas all examples of law enforcement we get in this movie are pretty much either corrupt or easily fooled.
Yeah. Yeah. They're making arrests and they're closing cases, but never making the world safer or getting to the truth of what actually happened. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And even on the beach, you know, like after Roger has killed himself, like the way that Marlo is talking to the police, it's like, what are we doing here? You know, like, how are we
so
not
many people?
Yeah, there's so many people. I also don't understand why all those people are there. It's just this weird sort of congregation on the beach after somebody's killed himself. I don't know who those people are, how they get there, why they're there. And just all of these things, I think, is combines to again show a passage of time in that people like doctors and police are just not what we would have perceived them to be in the 1940s or 50s, you know? It's like,
yeah,
Marlowe expects them to be able to do their job and they're just not.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And I'll go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and I think another something that ties into that visually in this movie is that we get a lot of different characters living in different heights, you know, like specifically when we see characters at home, we see them Roger Wade lives by the seaside, you know, ground level, sea level, whatever, and Marlo, we get him elevated, you know, he's got the windows all through his apartment, he can see the city, he has to ride up on a helicopter, or sorry, not a helicopter, elevator, he has to take an elevator up to his apartment, an elevator that looks like a panopticon, basically, like, and you know, it doesn't have the necessary windows to see the whole city at once, but it gives off that vibe. And you know, he's a private eye, and that's his job, is to sort of be all seeing, right? And we've already discussed whether or not he's actually good at that, but it sort of puts him in a place where he can see more of what happens in the city than somebody like Roger or Eileen, who live in, I don't want to say a traditional house, because that's not a traditional house because it's gigantic, but you know, some that live in one space where you can see your backyard and that's about it. And then eventually,
and they seem more concerned about their own lives, right?
Yes.
And they're kind of small, you know, they have parties with other beachgoers and other rich people who live in the same area, mm-hmm. but their world kind of seems to end there, and that's not the case for Marlo.
Exactly. And then when we get to to Marty Augustine's place, he's higher up than Marlo. And when we get the introductory shot to that that location, is like kind of a close-up of the back of Augustine's head, if I'm remembering correctly. And all you can see is the city in the background, you know, he's like, we're looking out his window, and you can just see how he can see even more of the city than Marlo could. And I think it's meant to represent not where these people necessarily rank in society, but where they rank in reality. You know, like, he's a criminal and he's a horrible person, but he's the man at the top, you know? And I think that's a relatively subtle way to sort of communicate something that I think the movie does pretty clearly otherwise. But I think adding that, those different levels, is really interesting. And the fact that, you know, these people, like these cops and these doctors and Roger and Eileen, and eventually, as we find out, Terry Lennox are, because Terry Lennox is hanging out at ground level as well. You know, we see at the end of the movie that all of these people are running around without the people higher up being able to notice them. You know, it's just sort of like rats scurrying around in the basement.
Yeah, and Marlowe's even another piece to Augustine, right? Like, he's above him and he sees him as another way to you know, another pawn to move, another
exactly
person to just get information from.
Yeah for sure. Wants to get the money back from Terry, which just sort of shows up, you know. But I mean, shows up because Eileen drops it off, but and I think that ties into the way that the camera moves in this movie. I don't know if you noticed this, James, but the camera moves pretty frequently in this film. Yeah,
I did. Yeah, and another quick sort of another quick separation from more of those 40s, 50s noirs where it's all about setting up sort of a beautiful frame. And it's not that the cameras never move in those films. It's not as though there's never any nice framing in this, but we're just so much more used to the still camera. And one of those reasons is just the technology at the time. It was harder to move cameras.
Yeah, of course.
You've talked about them being sort of heavier and clunkier and just harder to do these kinds of things with. Mm-hmm. But that does kind of quickly give this film visually such a different feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm pretty confident there's like a revolution in zoom lenses that happens in between these two eras. You know, like you find me a zoom in a noir film, you know, like a 1946 Humphrey Bogart movie or something. And whereas Altman was all about the zooms, and the idea in this movie is that the camera is always always either moving or zooming in or zooming out, and it gives you what you were describing, like noir as a general concept is like very not stilted or still but composed. And The Long Goodbye and Altman's approach to filming this particular noir is that it's feels more impulsive, you know. And it's not necessarily that there are these big grand like Spielberg wonders that are happening where everything's very precise with how the camera moves. It's just the camera is always moving. Feels like they're shooting with two cameras, whether or not that's true. And it's just like the camera's going to slide back and forth, and you're going to zoom when you feel like zooming and zoom out when you feel like zooming. And it's not that there aren't plenty of shots in this movie where there's like a list of actions that have to happen at the right times. But for a lot of these conversations, and I think the one between Roger and Marlo on the beach, when they're just sitting and talking to each other, I think that's a great example of a scene where the cameras are just kind of like gliding back and forth and also gliding in and out with the zooms. And it just sort of is something that runs through this whole movie. And I think Altman has talked about it. It was specifically to make this sort of voyeuristic feel, you know, like we're watching a private eye try to learn things. And the way the camera moves is, it's searching, you know, where the camera is doing what Marlo is doing. It's searching for the shot, and Marlo is searching for the answer to his questions. And I think it's an interesting way to tie those things together. And also going back to the heights of various locales, we get some interesting shots from above Marlo's apartment, from the level of his apartment looking down, and just sort of these zoom in shots, like I was saying, the sort of like overseeing of the city sort of vibe. I think that those shots specifically really, really drive home the idea of voyeurism and the idea of surveillance, which as we've talked about in other podcasts about movies from the 70s, like All the President's Men, The Conversation, a lot of overhead zoom shots happened in the 1970s. Yeah. Because there was a lot of talk of Watergate, and which is some very, very famous surveillance. And, I think this movie really reminds me, there are moments in this movie that remind me of Shampoo, which is another movie from around this time that uses overhead shots similarly, or at least one key one. And I just thought it was, it's both very of the time of the 1970s to sort of have this sort of voyeuristic style, but it's also commenting on the genre itself as sort of the idea of composed versus searching, you know. And I think that's another layer that Altman adds to the, I guess, critique of the genre.
I think you're right. It's with the moving camera, I think that those points you bring up are good. I think it's definitely about some of the things about surveillance I think are right on. And just as I said, with this movie not being as straightforward, it's not as though, you know, he finds out clue A, which leads to clue B, it's not as direct, you know. The route to the, I guess, conclusion of this movie is just a lot more circuitous. And I think that does get communicated with the way that the camera moves. And I think that, you know, as a time period, the 70s just had more going on in a certain way, and it's not as though the time that noir is popular or that it first hits is a simple time. You know, it's not as though everything was good. You know, we've talked about noir being a reflection of a lot of post-war anxieties and, you know, some of the atrocities of World War II. You know, there's all these things that make that time period have a lot to deal with, and, you know, a lot of moral, a lot of kind of contentious moral debates. You know, I'm not saying that it was a long time ago, therefore things were simple, but I just think that there is so many different things happening in the 70s, you know, just after the 60s and the Summer of Love, people being concerned about the younger generation and not really understanding it, and just increased globalization and all these things that made people, the older generation, sort of confused about what's happening. And there's even a line in this movie when Marlo's trying to explain what his neighbors do, in that they're into yoga and they dip candles, and the guy just says, "I remember when people just had jobs." You know, it's just like, it's just this notion of there are so, and we kind of touched on it too with kind of the health consciousness and the fad diets and what this doctor is doing, and we don't really understand what his approach to mental health or addiction is. I just think that there's all these different subcultures and trends and things showing up at this point that there's just so much to keep track of. And I think that's part of this ever moving camera, is that there are just so many different things that adults trying to keep a, like a thumb on the pulse of society would have to watch for. And that's not to oversimplify what was happening in past decades, because they also have a ton of things that were hard for society to deal with. But I just think with technology increasing and globalization, there's just even more to understand, and just a youth sort of revolution that I still think in 1973 is still so much new information for an adult to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not that this is the last time that happened, you know, like, I mean, we're still currently living in the greatest generation gap that's ever existed, right? Like the technology, or the people that grew up with phones as opposed to people who learned what the internet was at some point in their life, you know, like, and yeah, I think a changing of eras is always always worth noting. But yes, the, as you said, at this particular time in 1973, it was a clear sort of changing of the guard, I suppose is a bad term, but changing of the, are we sure the guard is the best guard for us, sort of thing, you know? Which I think The Long Goodbye is very much about. And one thing I think I definitely wanted to talk about was, what does this movie say about Hollywood? Because Robert Altman, when he talks about this movie, he talks about it as a, like it's a satire of Hollywood. And it's really interesting to, because I don't think I would have thought too much about that, aside from the hooray from Hollywood that opens and closes the film. And obviously that it takes place in Los Angeles, and we get various mentions of filmmaking and movies in general. I don't think I really would have come to that conclusion myself, you know? And
This isn't Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
No, it's not. Although this movie very clearly influenced Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know? And I just thought, I would be curious to know what you think about that, if anything.
Yeah, I kind of see that stuff. And yeah, I mean, kind of every movie you have to look at on its own, but when the director is saying something so specifically about it, you can't just ignore it. You know, I'm of the belief that once something's done, you can kind of interpret it however you want, but it is meaningful how much Altman talks about this being a Hollywood movie. And I think it speaks to, I think, what a lot of directors find interesting about noir, because I think they see themselves in it, in not necessarily noir, but the detective genre for sure. We get this notion of one man versus the city, that I say man intentionally because most of the time it is.
Yeah. This is, yeah, exactly. This is true of action movies in general, like just the, but yes, more specifically with noir, because a lot of times they're more searching movies.
Yeah. And the female characters, it's, you know, it's the stock character of a femme fatale, which isn't played in the most straightforward way here, but then again, this movie does a lot of things in the not most straightforward way, so that's kind of come to be expected. But we kind of have this, like, just think of a director or a screenwriter trying to break into Hollywood, you know, if, even if they came, especially if they came from a different part of the country and maybe not an urban part of the country. But we get this sort of lone character who's trying to make his way. You know, it's this, the detective's usually trying to find the truth about some case that they've been put on. But, you know, let's just swap in the struggle of trying to get a film made. You know, you kind of roam around, you're on your own, you're sort of hired by somebody else, but you're kind of employed by yourself. You know, you're a bit of a contractor. Mm-hmm. And you just bounce through all these different settings, you know, all these people who want to make your movie, people who want to finance it, people who, you know, you need to cast, people who, you know, just the various departments that you would need. And this is by the time you already signed on to make a movie, but just getting to that point, you bounce off all these people who have their own interests. You might mean a lot to them. You might mean nothing to them. You might, you know, I bring this up because the femme fatale in the genre, you probably bounce into some good looking women who maybe have an interest in you, maybe have a selfish interest in you. You know, you work very weird hours. You're up at night, I guess, a lot. Yeah. And you're just dealing with a lot of morally dubious people. So I hadn't really thought about it until this movie, but it just seems like something that a director or a screenwriter can really relate to. You know, the first time in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, there's just a lot of things that line up between these two characters that I hadn't considered until this one.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you can see the a lot of parallels between what you're saying and Robert Altman and his life. You know, I think he's from Kansas. I might be wrong about that, but, you know, middle of the country. And he didn't find success as a filmmaker really until he was approaching middle age. He's in his 40s. And I think that shows really helps to underscore the sort of like generation gap that we're seeing with Marlowe and everything else happening in this movie, yeah. You know? And I think that he fought in World War II. He's just kind of this, he comes to Hollywood as somebody who has lived a life already. You know, he's not somebody who grew up in the movies. You know, he's not not somebody who's born in California and ends up making movies when he's 32 or whatever. You know, he's somebody who he lived more life by the time he was 35 than I have, you know, and yes. Then he went and became one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. Yeah, on top of that, you know, and I think that that really shows the generational gap as well. And I think something that is also very notable throughout Altman's career is him having disagreements with the people who gave him money to make his movies. And I think you can really see that with the Marlowe struggle with Marty Augustine. I think Augustine is, that's something that, like, even before researching this movie, I was like, okay, well, Augustine is clearly a critique of people who fund Altman movies, you know, or movies in general, like just this guy who just, even aside from the violence and the fact that he's a criminal, like, just, I would not want to be around Marty Augustine. It seems like an absolute nightmare. And I thought that was an interesting criticism of people with money, and also to make a movie at a certain level, you need a lot of people with a lot of money around you. So you know, somebody like Altman has experience around these people. But yeah, I thought it was something that just, I don't know. And I think the thing that I really sort of link with a critique of Hollywood or a critique of violence in films, I guess, is the scene with the Coke bottle, which we have danced around to this point, yeah. Where Marty Augustine hits his girlfriend in the face with a Coke bottle, and it's very, very jarring. And I think there are other examples of violence against women in this movie, Eileen specifically, and we hear that Terry's wife Sheila, is that her name, is murdered, and we don't see evidence of that, but we're told that it's horrifying, but we don't see it, right? And
yeah, Eileen, she seems to be beaten to death, not
exactly
killed with any mercy or anything.
Exactly. And Eileen, we see a bruise, but we don't see the physical violence. Whereas, and I think that's something that you get a lot in classic noir. You see evidence of violence against women, but you don't see the actual violence. And I think with the Coke bottle scene, I think the idea with that is that Altman's being like, these movies are built on violence like this. They just never show you this violence. And to sort of, it's like a dishonest look at the world. Like, you have to show how repulsive this is to really be, to see how horrible this world is, you know? And I think that was in general his critique of, by avoiding violence, you're sort of dancing around the horrors of this world and this group of people who you're now making a story and profiting on, you know? And I think that's the closest thing I could find to like a real critique of Hollywood, is just sort of this idea that by showing this moment of very graphic violence and by making it jarring as possible, and it absolutely is, that's him saying that these are things that Hollywood dances around or glorifies in other movies, and just trying to show you how bad it really is. You know, whether or not that's successful, I'm kind of, I remain on the fence about. But again, this is also 1973, and I feel like if I was in my 30s and saw this movie in 1973, I think I would have a lot of different opinions on this movie in general, and specifically that scene. Yeah,
I think that's the most important one to point out, just because the nature of what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's sort of critical in the genre, I think, in the sense that, you know, during that interrogation, he says, oh, is this the part where I do this? And then you say, I ask the questions around here. And I think that just speaks to the way that these films were pretty formulaic and just not realistic in the way that films of that time period, you know, we often say that they're stilted or really staged, and they just don't look a lot like life. I think this movie does a lot of work to try to get away from that, even just in that same interrogation when the window is really scratched up and, you know, you don't get clear shots of it, and there are just dead ends and red herrings. And, you know, if you were to plot out the way that information is gained here, it's just not really straightforward. And mm-hmm. some things are left unexplained and some things are superfluous. And I think that that's part of the criticism of that genre, and just the way that it didn't reflect reality. You know, we get so many things sort of obscured. We already talked about that in the dialogue, but they're just, you know, everything's just sort of hazy and a bit more complicated. It takes a bit more work than, and not to say that every noir before this was super straightforward and intelligible, because I don't think that's the case either. But
no, I mean, my notes for every noir we've done to this point, half the time I'm just spending like writing down things that happen in the plot, because I find those movies kind of hard to follow, because I think plot is like in my top five things I'm most interested in a movie, but certainly it's closer to five than number one, you know?
Yeah. It's just a lot of things happen. So I think that, like in those noirs that you're talking about, but yeah, I think that, they're trying to be a bit critical of that form while obviously still loving it and still embracing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the most important one is that idea of the violence against women, and that, as you said, it's something that these movies deal with, but deal with at such a distance that it doesn't seem honest. And mm-hmm. so for them to do it, the violence that the way they do it in this one is just very disturbing, but just a much more accurate representation of how something like that goes. And you can't just, you know, put black eye makeup on one woman and then have everyone clutch their pearls and say that, you know, this was tough to deal with. This stuff is still nowhere close to dealing with it in actuality, but gets us, you know, a tiny bit closer.
Yeah, for sure. And the other moments that I think are kind of, I don't know, I think worth pointing out as we're talking about Hollywood, is the idea of the security guard who does impressions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's that moment when Marlowe's trying to escape from Harry and go to the Wade's residence, and he tells him he's the guy following him is a big Walter Brennan fan, you know? And so Harry's there like trying to figure out what's happening as this guy's doing this impression, this person he's never met. And at that, in that moment, like we're getting a representation of Hollywood literally used to distract somebody from the thing that matters the most in their life at that point. You know, it's distracting him from his job. It's just this idea of pop culture taking you away from what really matters in life, you know? And I think for the rest of the movie, most of the time, it's the existence of Hollywood or the existence of movies is referenced pretty sparingly, and usually with that specific security guard in different scenes. But I think that's the one time where something from Hollywood actively slows down the action of this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And Marlowe is using that, you know, sort of queuing up the security guard to do the work for him, but he's using that sort of knowledge of this guy's prowess as an impersonator, the Frank Caliendo of gated communities, apparently.
Hey, he's pretty good.
He is good. No, that is true. Yeah. Apologies to whoever played that security guard by comparing him to Frank Caliendo. But the but that is, you know, he's actively using Hollywood as a distraction, and I think that's worth noting. And I guess we're getting, oh, and Terry Lennox uses a fake name. Terry Lennox is not his real name.
Yes.
His real name is Lenny Potts, and I think that's sort of like a stage name, a comment on stage names. And by he's the one person we hear who has a fake name, and he's the person that our protagonist, or whatever we're calling Marlowe, is the most angry at the end, you know? He causes, Marlowe hates him so much that Terry causes him to perform an action as opposed to a reaction, you know?
It's someone who, I mean, we talked about how Marlowe doesn't believe that suicide when he hears about it.
Mm.
And so much of what he does between that point in the film and the end is that he knows who Terry is. You know, he wouldn't do this. He wouldn't murder his wife. He wouldn't kill himself in Mexico. There's all these things that Marlowe bases his actions on because of what he believes about Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it's fundamentally not true. First, that's not Terry. It's not his real name. But also we just learn that these really deeply held convictions of our main character are based on something that's incorrect because he's been deceived.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, he pulls out a gun and shoots his friend, or the person he thought was his friend. And I think that's, I don't really have a real read on it. I think the thing we have to talk about is the idea that, maybe this sort of ties into the critique of Hollywood a little bit. Like we hear Marlowe say the phrase, "It's okay with me," a handful of times throughout the movie, but like, not in a way that makes you think it's actually okay with me. And he says it at weird times, you know, like times when it's just like, that's not a phrase you would say in this situation. Like when he's leaving, he's been talking to the nurses about trying to see Dr. Behringer, and the nurses tell him that Dr. Behringer isn't there, even though he's standing right there. And he's like, those crazy ladies, it's crazy, as he's walking out, and he says, it's okay with me. Like, that's just not a situation where you would say it's okay with me, even if you're somebody who talks to yourself frequently. So yeah. It's just a weird, weird thing. And I think that phrase is something that Marlowe is doing to fit in with the time that he's actually in, as opposed to the time that he belongs in, you know? And it's this sort of just accepting the world as it comes to you, the candle dippers from next door, or the criminals like Marty and all these people he has to deal with. It's just, or the cops, he's saying, it's okay with me. Like, I'm just sort of quote unquote going with the flow. He's trying to be modern. And at the end, we find out that it's all an act. He just puts it on to try and fit in, even though he doesn't change his clothes to fit in. He can at least try to change one aspect of his personality to fit in, but there's a limit. And that's when I think the idea of the movie in that last second, or that last act that we see Marlowe do, I think the idea is supposed to be, at some point, you can try and fit in as much as possible, but at some point, the person that you are is going to come out. And I think that's the one time in this movie where we see sort of a 1940s kind of Marlowe come out. And it's this guy who's like, this is, there's right and there's wrong. And at some point, I've just got to pull out a gun and shoot the person who's doing the wrong thing, you know? And I think that's, it's kind of interesting. And especially the way that, his conversation goes with Terry just before, what he says, "You used me." I think Terry says, his response is, "That's what friends are for. Come on, have a drink." Like, just a quick heads up. That's not what you should say in that situation for people who are trying to maintain a friendship. And it was just, and I mean, even after that, I think Terry says nobody cares. And then Marlowe comes back at him and says, "Nobody cares about me," and then shoots him. And I think that's sort of the idea that we're supposed to get, is that like old fashioned right versus wrong Marlowe comes out for that 1 second. And then he goes back and tries to, he becomes the Marlowe who tries to actually fit in, the Marlowe who things are okay with afterwards, as we see him dance off into the distance, you know?
Yeah, it's such a weird phrase for this movie, I find, the okay thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he's saying it to, as if it's his, you know, this sounds sort of 70s new age, but if that's his mantra, you know, if that's something he says to himself to try to become more like that, which sounds so antithetical, is that he knows that that's not who he is, but he's trying to actively become more that way, so he kind of says this thing to himself to self-actualize it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, he's the type of person who wouldn't have a mantra, but he understands that somebody in the 1970s might try and have a mantra, so he's trying to fit in, you know. That's a really good point.
Yeah, and then this idea that, you know, that's what friends are for, is that it is the thing I was speaking about, that he bases so much of what he does throughout this movie based on what he believes he knows about Terry. And this is a good friend of his, and he wouldn't be friends with someone who is capable of murdering their wife, even though that's exactly what happened. And the last thing he says is, Terry says, "You're a loser," and he says, "Yeah, I even lost my cat," and then shoots him.
What
do you think of that being sort of the last thing that said, or invoking the cat once again, even though it's, you know, it was an important part of the beginning, and then kind of bounces up a few times in the middle, and then it's, you know, it's the very last thing I think he even says.
Yeah, I wonder if it's the idea that as we see Marlowe fail to get both get Curry brand cat food and fool the cat into thinking that he's got Curry brand cat food, and then the cat disappears. I think now that Terry's succeeded, he's gotten to the end point of his scheme, essentially. Like, if Marlowe doesn't kill him, it seems like him and Eileen get away clean. And I think the idea is that as soon as I was done, as soon as my cat realized I couldn't serve it anymore, it was done with me. And so he sees Terry as being done with Marlowe. You know, he's already succeeded, basically. Like, they could hang out, but there's nothing really that he can provide for him anymore. And, like, I don't think this is a particularly strong argument. I'm just trying to answer your question that you specifically posed to me. But I think that's the idea, is that he knows once he's done serving the people close to him, or the cats close to him, then they're done with him, and there's, to him, it's just like, what would I keep Terry around for? You know, it's like, he's just going to leave me, so I might as well make him leave, you know?
Yeah, it's because I think that he gets aligned with the cat throughout the movie. Marlowe does, you know, the way he's always asking for him. And then I think that the way that this might just be him not fitting in at this time period, but the negative reaction he gets from dogs throughout the movie too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like, he'll show up to a party where there's already dozens of people there, yet he gets singled out and the dog kind of chases him off barking. And I think tellingly at the house, he gets the house that's being sold, he gets called Mr. Katz or Dr. Katz. And people think that, you know, he's this other person and with this obviously very feline name. And by the end, I think that we learn, even though Marlowe has been fooled this whole time, ultimately, it wasn't a successful deception. And just like him trying to feed the cat at the beginning, you know, he goes through all these steps. It's remarkable changing the tins of the cat food, yeah. going into the other room, pretending to open it again in front of the cat so the cat will be fooled.
Yeah.
You know, all this work goes into deceiving him, but ultimately it's not a successful deception. I think that's what happened with Terry. Eventually, Marlowe does find out the truth about him, finds out who he really is, finds out that he's the kind of monster that actually can kill his wife, and in fact did. And you know, the way that he invokes the cat one more time, that he's such a loser that he lost his cat, and I think kind of has come to embody this cat by the end, mm-hmm. and is smart enough to see through the deception and act away, and is alone again. You know, we see these people with dogs are in big crowds, but we see the cat with Marlowe being independent. And when you talk about him compared to his female neighbors there, they all hang out outside and in groups of people and are talking and laughing, listening to music, where Marlowe has this very sort of isolated existence. And
yeah.
we see him float in and out through groups throughout this movie, but never really fitting in, as we said, never really communicating properly. And I think by the end, he's back to being that solitary cat who is not able to be fooled.
Yeah, exactly. And you raise an interesting point, like primarily indoors. When he's at home, he's indoors. When the women next door are home, they're outdoors. And the same is true a lot of time for Roger and Eileen, who we see at home more frequently than any other characters in these movies, and yeah, I think that's a good point. He's an indoor cat, you know. he goes outside when he has to, but he'd prefer not to, you know.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next time.